How we'll get humans to Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Three of NASA's top aces will tell us about the tremendous challenges we face and the steady progress we're making toward footprints on the red planet. Bill Nye and Bruce Betts also check in, and senior editor Emily Lakdawalla is right around the corner. Did you notice? That's the gorgeous new arrangement of our theme you hear in the background. Here's Emily. Emily, this week you've got at least a couple of blog entries to look at from the 25th and the 26th of May. Both images taken by folks that you've been in contact with. I'm most interested in this one from the 25th, where you actually asked somebody to take a look at something old.
I had been using in a talk an example of a somewhat garishly colored official release of an image of Saturn from the Voyager missions, and I wanted to compare and contrast it with what it would look like if you were actually there. So I asked one of my image processing friends, Ian Regan, to take a look at that data set, and he found a really nice one with the whole globe of Saturn tilted with several of its icy moons poised in front of it. It's just very pretty.
And it's accompanied by some images of the moon Ganymede.
Yeah, actually, that was the trigger for this post, was this amazing new color global portrait of Ganymede put together by Bjorn Johnson. He's been working on it for quite some time. The problem with this one was that it was color, it was global, but several of the frames for the image were smeared, and that was giving him a very difficult time trying to put it together into a full global view. It's something nobody has ever managed to do before. But finally, thanks to a conversation at unmannedspaceflight.com with somebody else who is also been working on smeared data sets, he found a new way to deconvolve the smearing and produce a nice, crisp portrait of Ganymede that is just lovely.
What does this tell us about this worldwide community of image processors?
Well, I don't think the insights are terribly deep, but they're worth repeating, and that's that people working together are better than people working alone, and that archiving these data sets for decades in ways that they can be used again brings rewards in brand new processing, both for beauty and for science, of data that was so hard won and that we're still getting great science and images out of.
We've still got a few seconds left. Could you say something about OSIRIS-REx having arrived in Florida?
Yes, for me, this is the start of any spacecraft journey to its eventual destination, the day when it's carefully boxed up in the place that it was first created and then shipped in very scary low-tech methods on trucks and airplanes to get to the launch site.
3 months away from launch now, roughly.
Very close, and then it'll be on its way to the asteroid.
Fascinating. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
That OSIRIS-REx piece, by the way, that was a May 23rd entry in her blog at planetary.org. You can check it out there. She is our senior editor and the planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Bill Nye is going to be up next. Bill, you know that I talked to Jason Davis and Bruce Betts in the middle of the day in the life test last week for LightSail. I was able to assure the audience that the test went well, but you were also there, and you saw some other things.
Yes, I saw some things. No, there was a problem at the end, an unexpected problem. This motor, which deploys the booms, which lets the sails to unfurl, allows the sails to unfurl, is a tricky thing in that it has counts. It has digital counts. And what we want to do is get the booms as extended as possible, but we don't want to overextend them, which is possible. So based on LightSail A or LightSail 1, they had a certain number of counts. They got to the number of counts and the sails were fully deployed, and so it seemed, and then they couldn't command it to stop. They couldn't get the motor to turn off.
Ouch.
They figured out that the motor has an electromagnetic field around it. You know, it's an electric motor. It's got spinning armatures. And that field just interferes with the antenna just enough to make it not read the signal. It was very cool. So
they
figured it out, and they changed it.
Spoken like a good scientist slash engineer, this problem crops up that could have been serious, and you said, it's really cool.
That's right, yeah. Well, it didn't happen on orbit, as we say.
Right.
That would have been a drag. And what would have happened there, they figured the motor would have drawn current long enough to draw the batteries down, then it would have rebooted. automatically and allowed the batteries to recharge and so on and so on. It's just these little decisions in the logic of the software are so important. The software is the key to this thing now. It's a team. And these guys working, these men and women working together figured it out.
So are we apparently go for launch now? I know there'll be other steps between now and then, but sometime
later. Yeah, let's take some other steps, but we're well on our way. And because SpaceX had its Falcon Heavy delayed, everything's delayed a little bit. And that enabling our LightSail team to get everything pretty well squared away. So we're feeling good about it. Oh, by the way, what was really good and gratifying to me as CEO and signer of checks is the cameras are working perfectly.
That's great.
Messing around we had last time. Yeah, it's software. Software. The lenses are fine. The charge couple devices are fine. It's getting the telemetry, getting the images sent back down to the Earth. So it was cool, Matt. You know, it went from that little antenna in the garage with glass doors through the glass out to an antenna at the other end of the Cal Poly campus, then back through the glass doors to the spacecraft. It's very cool.
Very cool indeed. I wish I'd been there next time, and certainly for the launch as we take one step at a time.
Yes, the launch is going to be exciting. If you're members, think about being in Cocoa Beach next spring. Probably, I'm shooting from the hip here, but probably around March.
Not too long to wait.
Thank you, Matt.
That's the CEO of the Planetary Society. We take you now to another place where he was, and I was, Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago for the Humans to Mars Summit and the panel that I conducted looking out toward Mars. Explore Mars is the group that brings the Humans to Mars Summit to Washington, D.C. each year. This close partner of the Planetary Society attracts hundreds of Mars movers and shakers to the three-day gathering. On the morning of May 17th, I took the role of moderator and welcomed three top NASA representatives to the H2M stage. Steve Jerzyk serves as Associate Administrator of the Space Technology Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters. He came thereafter serving as director of the agency's Langley Research Center. Jim Free is another former center director. He ran the Glenn Research Center for 3 years before moving to NASA HQ not long ago. Now he's deputy director of the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate. Rick M. Davis is also at NASA headquarters, where he is assistant director for science and exploration in the Science Mission Directorate. Rick co-leads a study that has begun the identification of potential landing sites on Mars for humans. Three different directorates, but all working toward that red planet goal. Our topic was the how and why of humans to Mars, but we concentrated on the how. What follows is no more than a sample of our conversation that considered everything from living off the land to changing policy as someone new moves into the White House next year. Almost all of the conversation is in the online version of this episode at planetary.org, or you can watch it, including PowerPoint slides, on the Explore Mars live stream channel. Let's start with SLS Orion. Things moving forward.
Absolutely, they are. This is the EM-1 Exploration Mission 1 crew module at the Kennedy Space Center shortly after it was delivered last year. It's undergoing outfitting now, first of some of the essential structure that was used to validate the proof pressure test, which was done just 2 weeks ago, where we went to 1.25 times the operating pressure. We're now adding secondary structure to the vehicle, some 500 plus pieces of secondary structure to the vehicle. So well on its way to the 2018 EM-1 mission. In parallel, we're working on the service module. We talk international. That's being developed by the Europeans. Actually, I'm going to Germany later today to have an event with the Europeans to celebrate delivery of the structural hardware for the EM-1 service module. On SLS, we're developing the tanks. They're being developed at Michoud in Louisiana, where the oxygen and hydrogen tanks are being assembled using in this incredible tooling. I mean, the tooling itself is an engineering marvel with friction stir welding. So we have the hardware in development. Again, the theme is we're developing the hardware going to Mars. We have our engine testing underway at Stennis Space Center, testing the RS-25, the former shuttle engine, expanding the envelope for this engine, using it well beyond what was ever intended for the space shuttle, operating at 109% thrust level, all new controllers. Eventually, it'll operate at 111% of its original operating parameters. And at the Kennedy Space Center in the Vehicle Assembly Building, you can actually see the outline of half of the SLS there. You can see the solid rocket motor outline in the platform with the core stage outline. The platforms are going into the VAB for this massive vehicle. And we're also working on the hardware that will it will ride out to the pad on the mobile launch platform, where all the systems go into the platform itself. At the bottom there, you think it's just a piece of structure holding it up. The systems in there for software, for air, for propellants are just incredible. And then, of course, they all have to run up to the towers across umbilicals. So that's my 1 minute on how are things going on SLS, Brian. Not a lot of progress.
There's a solid rocket booster test coming up?
There is, June 28th.
June 28th, okay.
Qualification motor, the second one in Utah.
And that tank assembly, where the tank was being welded, you talked about how innovative that is. It's done vertically.
It is, yes. So it's the segments go in and come out. It's almost like a Pez dispenser.
Let's keep going. We've already heard a little bit about developments in solar electric propulsion, and that really it's a question more of scale, since electric propulsion is coming on strong across the board for commercial payloads as well, commercial satellites. But what about nuclear thermal propulsion, the kind of stuff we saw in the movie The Martian that was driving that that huge ship? They didn't make a big deal about it, but they do mention at one point that there was a nuclear reactor on that vehicle.
Yep. So first, talking a little bit about high-power solar electric propulsion. So Jim Zoll Center, now the Glenn Research Center, really did a great job in developing two critical technologies for high-power solar electric propulsion. One are large area solar arrays to provide the energy and power to drive the engines, and those were with two industry partners. DSS developed the rollout solar array concept, and Orbital ATA developed their kind of fanful megaflex concept, and those were developed very successful ground demonstration units and tested. And actually, they've started to be commercialized in the commercial communication satellites where they need higher powers. The other technology was the higher power Hall thrusters, magnetically shielded to improve lifetime, 12.5 kilowatt thrusters. And we're actually in the process of awarding a contract to develop the flight hardware for that for the asteroid redirect robotic mission. So lots of good progress there. Now to get to actually answer your question, we have been working nuclear thermal propulsion technology at a low level for years. This year, Space Technology Mission Director at NASA is picking it up in our game-changing development program. The motivation for doing that is to reduce trip time for crew. That is the motivation. There are many human health and performance challenges with the now 18-month mission durations given the current chemical propulsion technology, and so we're really looking at advancing what we call rapid transit technologies like nuclear thermal propulsion to reduce trip time.
Steve Jerzyk, Jim Free, and Rick Davis of NASA with me on stage at the recent Humans to Mars Summit. Much more of our conversation about how we'll get men and women to the red planet is just ahead. This is Planetary Radio.
This is Robert Picardo. I've been a member of the Planetary Society since my Star Trek Voyager days. You may have even heard me on several episodes of Planetary Radio. Now I'm proud to be the newest member of the Board of Directors. I'll be able to do even more to help the Society achieve its goals for space exploration across our solar system and beyond. You can join me in this exciting quest. The journey starts at planetary.org. I'll see you there.
Do you know what your favorite presidential candidate thinks about space exploration? Hi, I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. You can learn that answer, and what all the other candidates think, at planetary.org/election2016. You know what? We could use your help. If you find anything we've missed, you can let us know. It's all at planetary.org/election2016. Thank you.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, this week bringing you most of my recent conversation with three leaders of NASA who are working very hard to get humans to Mars. That's the title of the summit that brought us together at George Washington University in mid-May. Steve Jerzyk is Associate Administrator of the Space Technology Mission Directorate. Jim Free is Deputy Director of the Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate. And Rick Davis is Assistant Director for Science and Exploration in the Science Mission.
Getting down to the surface, you said, and this is better than I thought, up to, you said 18 to 23 tons?
Three, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. That better than 30 tons, I suppose.
It used to be 30. We're refining the architecture and applying new technologies and getting it. Yeah, the range right now is 18 to 23. Yep.
Well, I'm told, I think Adam Stelzer, Rick Manning, two of the guys who know how to get stuff down to the surface, who are trying to figure this out right now, are out there in the audience someplace. Are we looking good? Are we going to figure this out?
Are we looking good? So that's kind of a loaded question. But so we are developing a suite of technologies to try to land larger masses on the surface of Mars. So first, kind of the first step would be a robotic Mars round trip mission. And oh, by the way, while we're going round trip, we might as well bring some samples back. So that's in collaboration with the Science Mission Directorate, right? The Mars Sample Return Mission. And we're looking at the ascent vehicle for that mission, depending on how much sample we want to bring back, of 3 to 5 metric tons. So that's getting from 1 to 3 to 5. And that would be a challenge, but something we can do in the nearer term. So there's several ways we can do that. One is a better aerodynamic drag device. And that could be a larger and more effective supersonic parachute. It also could be an inflatable that we use at supersonic speeds that we successfully demonstrated on the low-density supersonic decelerator project. So that was the good news on LDSD. We demonstrated the inflatable twice in a high-altitude test flight. The not-so-good news was the supersonic parachute structurally failed twice. So there's a lot of work to do in understanding the deployment dynamics of supersonic parachutes, including modeling of very chaotic, turbulent flows and the interaction of those flows with a very flexible structure. So we've got some work to do there in both modeling and simulation and physical understanding of that. But we're going to continue to do that and understand that better and figure out if designing a supersonic parachute is feasible with a bit better drag performance than the disc gap band parachute that we use now. Also, there's supersonic retropropulsion, which is an alternative to decelerate from supersonic speeds down to subsonic speeds. Hopefully, the first test of supersonic retropulsion on Mars will be through our collaboration with SpaceX on Red Dragon. Red Dragon's going to be on the 5 to 6 metric ton scale on crewed vehicle, and their plan is to slow down from supersonic speeds all the way down to the surface using retropropulsion. And so for NASA, it's an entry, ascent, and landing technology demonstration opportunity, and that was one of our prime motivations for collaborating with SpaceX on that.
Very quickly, life support. We haven't achieved yet anything like what's going to be necessary to send these people out with no resupply for the 2 or 3 years that they're going to be making that round trip. How is that coming along?
So that's where I get back to what we're doing on ISS today, right? We have goals that are set for what we think we need around Mars and hopefully get a chance to talk about architecture, but those are going to drive the architecture, and we're trying to prove those systems out today. Oxygen recovery as an example, 42-47% on ISS today. We're trying to get to 75% for these long duration missions. The place to test that out is on ISS. We're doing that today through some of the systems we're sending up, through what we have planned to do in the near term, where we're going to dedicate 4 racks on ISS to advanced ECLIS systems. That's the criticality of getting ISS the extension, which we have the 2024, and getting systems built and up there.
You know, on station, 8 years is going to go by really fast. Mm. And we were at a point now with the 50% of the experiment time that CASIS has to offer to commercial researchers and technologists, and the 50% that NASA has, we are more than oversubscribed with crew time available to do the experimentation. And so we are really going to have to prioritize, particularly on the NASA side, what are the critical things to get done on station before 2024, and we move out into cislunar space. And advancing life support technology is really critical. We got to get the efficiency way up. I'm not sure we have to completely close the loop, but that would be ideal, but we got to get the efficiency way up. And we've got to get the reliability way up, because if you've involved in station at all, you know how things kind of in general, but on the life support system side, kind of break down regularly, and we definitely have to get the reliability up. So yeah, Jim mentioned oxygen recovery and CO2 scrubbing. Also, we developed and delivered rapid cycle amine technology for better, more efficient CO2 scrubbing. And we're also looking at advanced technologies for the portable life support system for the future, EVA suits and surface suits. And so we developed things like variable oxygen regulators and better scrubbing technology for the portable life support system. So that is really critical. And then we're looking at even more advanced and more kind of far out concepts which couple environmental control and life support and ISRU, say food production, plant growth that also could provide not only food, but also CO2 absorption and oxygen generation, right? And we call those bioregenerative systems. And so we're looking at investing in research, lower TRL level research and technology development and things like bioregenerative systems where you're trying to create a mini ecosystem.
So ISRU, in-situ resource utilization.
Can I come back to that theme though? In my opening comments, I talked about how hard Mars is, but part of that's it's hard because we don't know it and we don't build it into our architecture as much as maybe we need to. The interesting thing about ECLIS for me personally is that, you mentioned 3 years. Well, reality is we're probably going to pre-position supplies and logistics in a Mars parking orbit. So really, you're not talking 3 years. You're talking a much smaller amount of time that actually does start to approximate what we've learned on ISS. And so building that into the whole equation and potentially even pre-positioning on the surface of the planet, that really offloads what the technologies need to be there. I was actually in the ISS flight control when we put the urine processing assembly on board, which was not ready for prime time, I might add it. Time. But the point being is we got through it, we got the parts on there, and if you have that logistics supply chain in place, you can make really amazing things happen.
NASA's Steve Jerzyk, Jim Free, and Rick Davis with me at the Humans to Mars Summit in Washington, D.C. on May 17th. I want to thank Explore Mars for giving me the opportunity to talk with them and to share our conversation with you. We close, as we always do, with Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. Welcome back.
Thank you.
What are you going to tell us about Mars?
I know I'm boring, but now's the time. Every 26 months is the best time to see Mars, and this is it. The brightest it's been for more than a decade, brightest it'll be until 2018 when it will be brighter. But still, I encourage you to go out and see it. It's over in the evening east or southeast. It is the brightest star-like object over there. It is brighter than any star in the sky right now. It is near yellowish Saturn, which is much dimmer at the moment, and the red star Antares, which is also dimmer because I don't know if I mentioned it, but Mars is really bright right now.
You know what I remembered? That 11 years ago, the last time Mars was this bright or even brighter, closer, we were throwing a birthday party for Ray Bradbury, the original Martian.
We were indeed. Not as bright as it was then, but still awfully stunningly bright right now. All right, we move on to this week in space history. Appropriately, in Mars land, 1971, Mariner 9 was launched, which it would become the first Mars orbiter. 1966, Surveyor 1 landed on the moon, becoming the first U.S. soft lander on the moon or anywhere else in the solar system. We move on to random space fact.
And our rolling is a big hit with a lot of people in the audience, though not everyone, I suppose.
Glad I could help. As seen from Earth, Mars is nearly 100 times brighter at its brightest than it is at its dimmest. The difference is mostly due to the distance between the Earth and Mars, but is also affected by how close or far away from the Sun Mars is in its somewhat elliptical orbit.
Let's move out one more planet in the solar system for the contest.
All right. On what date is Juno scheduled to enter Jupiter orbit? How'd we do, Matt?
I have to admit that I may have accidentally held down the number of entries this week. We still had a good number, about average. But I didn't update the contest question on the website for a few days. I was busy. I was in Washington. And It got away from me, so I apologize to those of you who missed out or got confused. We still came up with a bunch, and out of those, Random.org has picked Jace Pearson. Jace Pearson, don't know where he's from, but he's an astronomy informal educator, a NASA Solar System Ambassador. Juno's going to reach Jupiter on the 4th of July, 2016.
He is indeed correct. It's very exciting. A new giant planet's orbiter.
Jace, you lucky guy. You're going to get, you're the first winner, Off-World Trading Company, that great new game, engaging economic strategy game set on Mars. And because you were the first person chosen by random.org, you're also going to get a 200-point iTelescope.net account. And the next couple of people that we've also got coming up here, they are also winners of Off-World Trading Company. The first of them is Nadav Mayo, I'm not sure I pronounced it correctly, in Israel. Nadav discovered that, at least according to the mission website, Juno's going to be the fastest man-made object out there until it starts to fire its rocket to be inserted into Jupiter orbit. I did not know that.
I could buy that, because the others, as they get farther and farther from the sun, slow down as they're being tugged on constantly by the sun. But that's it's interesting.
Katie Fritcher reminded us that Juno is named for the Roman goddess Juno, the wife of Jupiter. And like the Roman goddess, she says, the spacecraft will peer under the clouds of Jupiter. Her penetrating eye will reveal what mischief the giant is up to.
Oh, mischief.
Mythological mischief. Katie, you're also going to get a copy of Off-World Trading Company. You can take us right on to next week, I think.
Well, I'm going to bring us back to Mars because I can. At its closest approach, occurring right now in 2016, how big is the disk of Mars in the sky as seen from Earth? Measured in arc seconds. Go to planetary.org/radio contest. So how big is Mars at closest approach 2016 in arc seconds?
You have until Tuesday, June 7th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us this answer. And once again, we're going to give away three more copies of Off-World Trading Company, that online game that Bruce has tried out and gave the Director of Science and Technology a seal of approval to. That might be a little bit overboard, my saying that. There's the seal now. And the grand prize winner, once again, a 200-point iTelescope.net account. We're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about boats. Thank you, and good night.
He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. How many times can I say that? I guess Juno's kind of a boat. It's going to sail the skies of Jupiter. That's a stretch. Nevertheless, he joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its high-flying members. Josh Doyle composed our lovely theme. Here is the exciting new arrangement of that theme by film and TV composer-arranger Peter Schlosser. You'll be hearing it a lot in the weeks to come. Enjoy. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.